So, if you sit down for, a grueling 3.5 hour English exam and you score a 150 out of 190, you fail.
Right.
You do not get the qualification you paid for, but you don't actually walk away empty-handed, which is wild to me.
Yeah, it's a very specific system.
Right, because the grading system triggers this like hidden safety net, and Cambridge hands you a completely different certificate instead.
Exactly.
So, welcome to the deep dive to all the learners out there listening. Whether you are aiming for a promotion or applying to university or just, trying to prove to yourself that you can master this language, this deep dive is your roadmap. Our mission today is to give you a complete strategy map for one of the most popular and honestly surprisingly misunderstood English exams in the world.
It really is misunderstood.
Yeah. And we were pulling from official Cambridge guidelines, assessment handbooks, and some really practical preparation material from IdiomS. We'll learn to decode this whole test. So, okay, let's unpack this. What exactly is the qualification we're dissecting today?
So we are looking at an assessment of practical independent English at the CEFR B2 level.
Okay.
It's a qualification designed for learners who can communicate effectively in, many academic, professional, and everyday situations. And the current official name of this qualification is Cambridge B2 First.
Cambridge B2 first. I mean, that sounds very clean, very standardized. But let's clear up a massive source of confusion right out of the gate here.
Sure.
Because if I walk in through language school or I look at a job board in Europe, I rarely see B2 first. I hear people talking about taking the first, or they use these three letters FCE.
Right.
Are these like entirely different tests?
Not at all. No, they're exactly the same exam.
Okay.
So historically, the exam was called the First Certificate in English. And the historical abbreviation for that is FCE, which we usually just pronounce aloud as FCE.
Got it.
What happened was, over time, Cambridge renamed their entire family of exams so that the title transparently includes the CEFR level. So the FCE became B2 first.
Oh, okay. So it sounds exactly like a famous consumer brand changing its logo and its packaging, but keeping the exact same recipe inside the bottle.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. Yeah.
Yeah.
People, institutions, language schools, they all still habitually use the old name.
Because old habits die hard.
Exactly. Old habits die hard. But if you see a job advertisement and it asks for the FCE, your B2 first certificate is exactly what they're asking for. It is the same recipe.
Well, that clears up so much right away. But before we get into the tactics of how to actually pass this thing, we need to address the strategy of choosing it in the first place.
Right.
Why should a candidate dedicate months of their life to Cambridge B2 first when there are, other heavyweights out there like IELTS or TOEFL?
Well, the primary strategic difference really comes down to the lifespan of the result.
Okay.
Exams like IELTS and TOEFL typically have a practical expiration date.
Huh.
For most institutions, those results are only valid for 2 years.
Oh, wow. Only 2 years.
Yeah, because language proficiency can fade if you don't use it. But Cambridge certificates do not expire.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah, the B2 first certificate itself has no expiration date printed on it.
So it's like a permanent addition to your CV. I mean, that sounds like a massive advantage, but surely there's a catch, right?
There is a crucial nuance here, yes. Even though Cambridge does not expire the certificate, individual universities, professional bodies, or employers decide how many years back they will accept a result.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, Cambridge states this explicitly in their guidelines. You cannot assume an old certificate guarantees current acceptance everywhere. Candidates must verify the exact qualification and score required by their target institution.
Okay, so that changes the calculus a bit. You have to work backwards from what the employer or the university actually wants.
Precisely.
Let me throw a realistic candidate scenario at you then. Let's say I am applying for a visa to migrate to Australia or Canada, and I know I need a B2 level of English. Isn't B2 first just as good as IELTS, since, they're both highly respected official exams?
I really have to issue a strong warning against that assumption.
Oh, really?
Yes, immigration departments do not operate on what is quote unquote just as good. They use very strict closed lists of accepted exams.
Gotcha.
So, choosing B2 first for permanent CV accreditation in Europe is a brilliant strategy. But IELTS is often strictly required for specific visas and migration pathways.
So they might just reject the Cambridge one outright.
Exactly. Taking the wrong exam because you assume it will be accepted is a very expensive, frustrating mistake. Always confirm the exact list of accepted exams for your specific visa before you book anything.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Now, here's where it gets really interesting to me, the scoring system itself.
Okay.
Let's assume you've checked the requirements and B2 first is your target. How does the grading actually work? Because we aren't just dealing with a simple pass-fail here, are we?
No, we are not. The exam uses the Cambridge English Scale. The reported score range for B2 First is from 122 to 190.
Okay, 122 to 190.
Right. And to achieve a passing grade and earn the B2 certificate, you need to reach a minimum of 160 points.
So 160 is the baseline to pass.
Yes. A score of 160 to 172 gives you a passing grade C. If you score between 173 to 179, you earn a grade B. Both clearly prove your independent B2 level.
But let's go back to that hidden safety net I mentioned at the very beginning of the deep dive. What happens to the candidate who sits through the whole 3.5 hours, has a moment of panic on the reading section, and ends up with, say, a 150?
This is a fascinating mechanism within the Cambridge system. If a candidate scores between 140 and 159, they do not get a B2 certificate.
Right.
However, Cambridge does issue a B1 level certificate.
That's so cool.
Yeah, the test makers recognize that even though you missed the B2 mark, you conclusively demonstrated practical English ability at the level directly below it.
That is incredibly forgiving. I mean, it takes away that terrible all or nothing pressure that exams usually have.
It really does.
What about below 140, though?
Well, to be perfectly accurate, if you score between 122 and 139, those scores are reported on your official statement of results so you can diagnose your performance, but no certificate of any kind is issued.
Okay, good to know. Now, let's look at the other end of the extreme, the top of the scale. I have heard this rumor circulated by candidates on forums and social media for years.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to ask.
The myth goes like this. If you get a nearly perfect score on the B2 First, Cambridge rewards you by giving you a C1 advanced certificate instead.
I am thrilled you brought this up. This raises an important question about how the scale works, and we really need to correct this massive myth using the exact parameters Cambridge sets.
Please do.
Okay, so a score of 180 to 190 is a grade A. A score of 180 to 190 gives you a B2 First certificate stating that you demonstrated ability at CEFR C1. It is not a C1 advanced certificate and does not replace the broader C1 advanced examination.
Okay, let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. It is like a car speedometer.
Okay, go on.
Just because you can push a standard family sedan to hit 180 kilometers per hour on a straight road, it doesn't mean you're suddenly driving a Formula One race car.
Right.
It proves you have incredible speed capability in that specific vehicle, but you are not qualified to enter the Formula One race.
That is the perfect mechanical analogy. The C1 advanced exam tests a much wider, deeper range of complex language, abstract concepts, and nuanced tones that simply are not present on the B2 First test paper.
So you just can't prove you know them.
Exactly. You showed C1 ability on a B2 test, but you never walk out of the B2 exam with its C1 advanced certificate.
So what does this all mean for the candidate sitting in the exam room? How do we actually accumulate those 160 points? Let's break down the anatomy of the test.
Sure. The exam takes roughly 3 hours and 29 minutes to complete. You will face 4 distinct papers. Reading and use of English, writing, listening, and speaking.
4 papers. But earlier you mentioned we get 5 individual scores that make up our final grade. I'm looking at the math here. How do 4 physical test papers generate 5 different scores?
This is a slightly confusing mathematical twist for many candidates. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes perfect sense. The very first paper you sit for is called Reading and Use of English. Even though you take it in one sitting in one booklet, it generates 2 completely separate scores.
Okay.
The reading score is based on parts 1, 5, 6, and 7. The use of English score is based on parts 2, 3, and 4.
Wait, why go through the trouble of separating them? And just to be clear, neither of these has anything to do with the writing score, correct?
Correct. Never confuse use of English with writing. They're totally different. The reason they are separated is that they test fundamentally different mental muscles.
Okay, how so?
Well, the reading score, which again is parts 1, 5, 6, and 7, tests your comprehension of long texts, your ability to extract detail, infer meaning, and understand the author's opinion.
Like actual reading skills.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the use of English score, parts 2, 3, and 4, is a precision test of your grammatical mechanics and vocabulary depth.
That makes perfect sense. One tests your ability to absorb ideas. The other tests if you know how the gears of the language actually turn.
That's a great way to put it.
So we have a reading score, a use of English score, a writing score, a listening score, and a speaking score. 5 equal scores.
Exactly. And your final result on the Cambridge English Scale is simply the average of those 5 scores added together and divided by 5.
Let's dive into the mud a bit. I want to look at exactly what each paper tests, and more importantly, the psychological and mechanical traps that cause candidates to fail.
Let's do it.
Let's start with that massive double paper, Reading and Use of English.
So this paper is 1 hour and 15 minutes long. This is historically where candidates lose the most points, usually because they misunderstand what the test makers are actually looking for.
Give me an example.
A great example of a mechanical trap is in part four, the keyword transformation.
How does that work?
You are given a complete sentence, a specific keyword, and a second sentence with a gap. You have to rewrite the second sentence so it means the exact same thing as the first, and you must use the keyword provided.
What about the reading comprehension sections? Where do people stumble there?
The biggest conceptual trap is in part six.
Okay, what happens at part six?
In this part, you are presented with a text that has empty gaps, and you have a list of removed text that you must put back into the correct spaces. A very common misconception is that entire paragraphs have been removed.
They aren't.
That is entirely incorrect. In part six, sentences have been removed from the text, not paragraphs.
Why does that distinction matter so much? Sentences versus paragraphs, I mean, they're just chunks of text, right?
Because it changes what you are looking for. If you are looking for paragraphs, you are looking for broad thematic ideas. But because they are sentences, Cambridge is actually testing micro-level cohesion.
Oh, I see.
They are testing if you understand how pronouns and logical connectors act as hinges between thoughts. If the sentence before the gap ends with, "He bought the red one," the missing sentence in the gap likely starts with something like, "However, this decision proved costly." You are looking for the word this. It is a test of structural glue, not just general meaning.
Look for the hinges. That is brilliant. Let's shift to the writing paper. 1 hour and 20 minutes. What is the gauntlet here?
Well, you face two parts. Part one is a compulsory essay. You have no choice. You must write it based on the prompt.
Okay.
Part two gives you a choice of formats. Depending on the exact exam, you might choose to write an email, an article, a report, or a review.
I know exactly what the trap is here because I hear it from every single language learner. The word count.
Ah, yes.
The instructions specifically say to write between 140 and 190 words. If I write an absolutely stellar essay, but it's 210 words, do I automatically fail?
Absolutely not. The 140 to 190 word limit is a recommendation to respect task completion and communicative effectiveness. Do not think of it as an automatic pass or fail boundary.
But why give a limit at all if it's not a strict rule?
Because significantly short or long answers naturally damage your score based on the grading criteria.
How so?
If you write 300 words, you almost certainly included irrelevant information, lost your logical organization, and failed to communicate concisely. The examiner gets lost in your rambling.
That makes sense.
And if you write 90 words, you fail to answer the prompt fully or provide enough complex language to demonstrate a B2 level. The examiners are grading how effectively you communicate the required information, not coldly counting every single word to penalize you.
So write 200 words if it perfectly completes the thought. But don't write a novel.
Exactly.
Next up is the listening paper. Roughly 40 minutes, four parts, 30 questions. What's the hidden mechanism here?
The structure is your biggest advantage here. Every track is played twice.
Okay.
The trap is how candidates allocate their mental energy. They panic during the first listen, trying to instantly confirm the final answer.
Yeah, I would probably do that.
Most people do. But what you should be doing is using the first listen to grasp the general context, tone and speaker attitude, and selecting a tentative answer. The second listen is solely for precision checking that tentative answer against the specific vocabulary used.
Got it. First listen for the vibe, second listen for the evidence.
Exactly.
Finally, the paper that gives everyone nightmares. Speaking. 14 minutes, four parts, face to face. And you don't do it alone.
That's right. You take it with a partner, another candidate, and there are two examiners in the room.
Oh, two?
Yeah. One examiner interacts with you, the interlocutor, while the other sits quietly, assesses your language, and inputs grades.
Let me role play the absolute worst case scenario. I sit down, I'm nervous, the examiner asks me a question, and I immediately use the present continuous instead of the present simple. A glaring, stupid grammar mistake. Have I just failed the speaking paper?
No, and this is a critical factual correction we must make. One mistake does not automatically fail a candidate.
Thank goodness.
You are assessed holistically on your overall performance over the entire 14 minutes. Examiners expect nervous lips.
Okay, second nightmare scenario. What if my partner is an absolute bulldozer? What if they won't stop monologuing and I just can't get a word in?
This raises an important point about how the grading rubric works. You are graded on your own language production, yes, but there is a specific, separate score given for interactive communication.
Interactive communication. What does that actually mean in a 14-minute test?
It means weak collaboration can actively reduce your score.
Oh, wow.
In part three, you are explicitly tasked with discussing a mind map topic with your partner. The goal is to negotiate, share opinions, and try to reach an agreement. If your partner is dominated with the conversation, the examiners are watching to see if you have the language tools to handle it.
So what do? I can't just yell, shut up.
Exactly. You use polite structural interruptions. You say, that's a really interesting point, and I'd add that. Or, I see what you mean, but have you considered?
Oh, I see.
Your job is to secure your interactive communication points by actively managing the conversation. And if your partner is freezing up and silent, you secure your points by asking, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah.
You are being graded on your ability to be a functional conversationalist.
I love that. You can turn a bad partner into an opportunity to show off your management skills.
Exactly.
So knowing all these traps is only half the battle. Now we need a clear preparation system. We need an action plan to go from staring at a textbook to being completely test ready.
Well, the very first decision in your action plan is choosing the medium. You can take the Cambridge B2 first on a computer or paper-based.
Okay, question. Does taking it digitally give me an easier set of questions?
No. Digital and paper-based candidates do not receive identical questions on the day. Test versions always vary for security reasons across different centers.
Makes sense.
However, both formats assess the exact same skills, follow the exact same exam structure, and lead to the exact same qualification.
Yeah.
The digital version isn't easier or harder. It is purely a mechanical choice. Do you process information better by highlighting with a mouse or by circling words with a pencil?
Let's build out a 4-step, 4-week action plan for our listeners based on the resources we have from Idiomas Way Learn. What is step one?
Step one is diagnose. Never start your preparation by blindly memorizing advanced vocabulary lists.
Right.
You must take a full practice test under timed conditions to see where your baseline actually is. Start with test one, which covers all the parts of the exam. Figure out if reading is your enemy or if listening is your weak spot.
Okay, step one, diagnose with a full test. What is step two?
Step two is build the base. Often, candidates struggle with B2 reading texts, not because the B2 concepts are too hard, but because their underlying grammatical foundation is cracked.
It's like trying to put a Ferrari engine into a golf cart. The structure simply cannot handle the power.
Exactly. If you still struggle to understand the difference between the present perfect and the past simple, trying to learn complex B2 idioms like once in a blue moon will not save your use of English score. You must solidify your B1 grammar base before layering on B2 complexity.
Step three. We have our diagnosis. We fixed our golf cart structure. Now what?
Step three is master connectors. This is the ultimate form of deliberate practice for this specific exam.
Connectors?
Dedicate serious time to mastering cohesive devices, words like moreover, nevertheless, provided that, and furthermore.
Why are those specific words the secret weapon?
Because they hit two birds with one stone.
Let's see.
In the writing paper, using connectors properly proves to the examiner that you can logically organize complex arguments, which directly boosts your communicative effectiveness score.
Right.
And in the use of English paper, particularly in the gap fill exercises, these are the exact structural hinges the test is actively trying to see if you know.
Okay, step one, diagnose. Step two, build the B1 base. Step three, master the structural connectors. What is the final step? Step four, to ensure we are ready for exam day.
Step four is simulate the environment. 2 weeks before your test, doing exercises while listening to music or checking your phone is useless.
Guilty.
You must simulate the mental marathon. Sit down, set a timer for 1 hour and 15 minutes, and do a complete reading and use of English paper without stopping. Train your brain to endure the specific time pressure of the Cambridge format.
That is a phenomenal blueprint. As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to pivot away from the scores and the time limits for just a second. What is this grueling preparation process actually doing for the candidate in the real world?
What's fascinating here is that the B2 first is not just an academic hurdle to jump over. The deliberate practice required to pass this exam, learning how sentences hinge together, understanding subtle opinions in a long article, politely managing a dominating speaker in a conversation, it genuinely rewires how you process the English language.
Wow.
You transition from a passive student to an active, precise communicator.
It forces you to look at the matrix of the language. So next time you are reading a news article or listening to an interview in English, don't just listen to the words. Ask yourself, where are the connectors? How is the speaker proving their point? How did the journalist transition between paragraphs? You are not just studying for a Tuesday morning exam anymore. You are deciphering the mechanics of global communication. See you on the next deep dive.